Welcome back, everyone. This is Eric Ellefson with the Digital Education Podcast. If you've been listening, you know I love talking with people and experts and just people who love education in regards to innovation and education, leadership, but then also education policy. And today I'm with Tommy Schultz, who is the National Communications Director for the American Federation for Children. The AFC is the largest school choice advocacy group in America dedicated to empowering families, especially lower income families, with the freedom to choose the best K-12 education for their children. And Tommy's been involved in gubernatorial elections, congressional campaigns, and he's been involved in American politics and policy for a while now. And Tommy, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate this. I get jazzed up about these conversations. I know a lot of my friends who listen do too. But I'm really intrigued, as we start, how'd you get, you've been interested and you've been involved in politics and policy, but why education? How did you get involved in education? And then where did that interest kind of develop and come from?
Sure. Well, I guess my interest in education goes back to my own schooling, to where my parents really placed a premium on getting my sister and me a great education, giving us any opportunity that we were able to achieve. And I really appreciate their sacrifices and what they did for my sister and me, because we grew up in a rural community. My parents were farmers. And, my mother and father really wanted us to go to private schools, Catholic schools in particular, and getting around to private schools in rural areas isn't always the easiest thing to do. But my parents really made sacrifices. And when we got to high school, my sister and I both went to schools that were 60 miles away from where we grew up. So it was quite the challenge. But for me, my parents told me all the time that, we want to give you every opportunity that you can. If you work hard, if you make the grades and you can get into these schools, we'll make sure to figure out a way to get you there. And so ended up going to Catholic schools all K through 12, and then went to Stanford for college. And then I got into politics because that really became a passion of mine, I would say, especially towards the end of my college career. I started out pre-med and tapped out pretty early because it was getting rather difficult. I wasn't enjoying it as much as I thought I would. And I saw only another decade more of schooling in front of me. And so I knew I didn't have the passion for that. And then I got into the education reform realm a few years later, to where I was seeking out some job opportunities. And this work came across the dashboard and worked specifically with the Federation for Children out in Tennessee. They were looking for a Tennessee communications director. And I looked into our group, which is my where I currently am, of course, at the national level now, though. And this was back in 2015. And I saw that this group believed in giving kids educational opportunities no matter where they are, so and no matter the setting. So whether that's a charter school, whether that's a private school, AFC was one of the few groups that I encountered that really believed in all options for kids. And I liked that message. And then I liked where they were actually, rather than just simply talking the talk, they were walking the walk. And I looked at all the various disclosures and saw that the Federation for Children was getting involved in elections, because at the heart of our movement of providing kids better educational opportunities is creating laws and legislation and passing policy. And you just simply can't do that in a vacuum, and it doesn't just happen organically. You have to work and build coalitions and get the right people elected. And I saw that AFC was willing to stand with men and women of both the Democrat and Republican parties. And I saw that within Tennessee, they were really dedicated to making that happen. And that's what really first got me intrigued, because I believed in the issue. I saw that having access to a great education certainly changed the trajectory of my life. And then I looked at some of these statistics that of course, by heart, of how largely our system of K through 12 education is failing in many regards, especially in distressed communities with disadvantaged families, and especially in communities of color, where they are really dramatically impacted by a flawed system of education, in my opinion, and I think almost factually and objectively. And after I started into the work, once we started visiting schools, and once you start visiting the types of kids that you're helping in those communities that I brought up before, particularly in Memphis and Nashville. That's where it really tugged at my heartstrings. And for me, it felt like a calling to where, you know, this is where I was going to end up in my life, because we would hear, you know, the global statistics about, you know, test scores and how badly someone's performing. But when you really get to meet some of these children and you get to see that if only they had a different option, if only their family in the current landscape, if only their family could afford to go to a private school or move to a different school district, then their lives might be changed. And it gets almost very tough to think about the statistics and what that might mean for the individual. And I remember one particular school visit where we were, you know, going around to a school in Memphis, and it was a school that would have certainly taken either some form of a scholarship, whether that was a tax credit scholarship or a voucher, or you name it, if it had been in the law in Tennessee at the time. I think this was around 2016, maybe. And I remember we were touring the school, wonderful little school, but really only thriving off of the generous but limited contributions of some anonymous individuals and other philanthropists in Memphis who were keeping the school open in many regards. It was in a tough neighborhood. You could see some of the schools that, you know, the state lists as failing just, you know, a stone's throw away from this school. And these kids were happy. They were disciplined. They were seeming, you know, to do incredibly well in their academics. They had, you know, we visited little pre-K three kids, and that's actually, I think, on my Twitter profile, the picture of the kids there. I always keep that picture up because it gets emotional for me when we were asking the teachers and some of the administrators, what are the issues that these kids are facing? I mean, they said they had a number of homeless kids, that they're always trying to find, you know, for, and the school is helping them trying to find the next, you know, the next meal, the next place to sleep. And they have this wonderful little community that's engaged to help some of these kids. And then I remember one of the teachers told a coworker of mine after he asked, you know, what are the issues that you're facing? And they were bringing up some of these issues of poverty and some of these general issues of violence. But, you know, the real story that they brought up, or that she brought up, was that, you know, they were, it was a Catholic school. And so they went to church that morning. It was part of their weekly mass that, well, similar to what I had growing up in K through 12, where you went to mass once a week and some usually like a Friday or something like that. And one of the little girls tapped on the teacher's shoulder and asked for her to pray for her father. And the teacher asked why. And she says, oh, well, my father just got out of the hospital this weekend. He was shot. And so you think about this, I mean, a little six-year-old girl having to encounter that sort of challenge on a weekly basis. And, you know, for me at that point in my life, after having a pretty glamorous and pretty incredible career in politics and working with really dedicated public servants and leaders and seeing what that life is like, and then thinking down to what a little six-year-old is having to go through on her day-to-day just educational path, and how you can only imagine how any other person would potentially you know, take that sort of circumstance and potentially be ruined by it. And these kids are getting to school every day by any means necessary. The school is, you know, reaching out and trying to make sure every kid gets to school safely, you know. And so for me, when I met, you know, those kids and those teachers and heard what they were doing, you know, there was a certain level of urgency that I brought to my work from then out. And then all of a sudden, I come to the national role by way of the fact that after the 2016 presidential election, our former board chairwoman, Betsy DeVos, was nominated to be Secretary of Education. And then I got the promotion up here to be the National Communications Director, which I think was somewhat another, you know, funny circumstance, to where I had this background in politics, which is a bit more like hand-to-hand combat in some sense. and I think it was helpful that I had that experience, because the past few years have certainly been a bit of a war. Our opponents in the education establishment, who want to keep their grip of power, they're throwing everything at us. And interestingly enough, the poll numbers are showing that their attacks aren't really effective. So I think that's partly because the coalition of those that support choice and educational options You know, they're fighting hard. We're fighting hard, certainly state by state, to grow these options. And I think too, parents are getting even more engaged. I mean, now school choice or educational choice, education freedom, whatever you want to call it, I mean, it's in the limelight. And I think parents, you know, because we're starting to challenge these notions that, look, your zip code shouldn't simply determine the rest of your life, or, you know, why is it that we even have this system? And you do, you know, 2 minutes of Googling and you find out this is largely constructed in the 1850s or 60s. It's rather incredible that we have the system that we do. And ultimately, it's letting millions of kids fall through the cracks. And I think parents are getting more engaged. You see it in like the Florida governor's race, this past go around, where parents really mobilized in support of the now governor, Ron DeSantis, who said, I want all options for kids. The other candidate, Andrew Gillum, said, I want to bring all these scholarship programs to a conclusion. You know, you're essentially telling lower income families, you know, in those Florida programs, for instance, $25,000 a year, average family income, 68% African American or Hispanic. You're telling those families, I'm going to pull your kid out of school next year. I mean, so that's where I think parents, now that there has been some sense of scale and a lot of kids enrolled into charter schools or into private schools, thanks to scholarships, they become politically engaged and activated on this issue, because every parent, I'm not a parent yet, but from what I can tell, every parent wants to give their kids a better education. Every parent wants to give their kid opportunities that, you know, that parent may not have had. So I think the landscape is looking good. It's certainly going to be challenging over the next few years because, as I said, our opponents are just getting more organized, and they're coalescing around, you know, their bit of power that they've got in this system. So it should be a fun couple of years, but that's the long story of me getting into this work.
Well, and it's amazing because there's so many different directions I could go with it, especially, I mean, one of the things, maybe if we got time at the end, I'll ask you about kind of, you know, we focus so much on ed policy on the urban landscape over the last maybe 20 years, and that's still where, you know, the substantive and a significant need is. But the one that, you know, is maybe more, you know, personal to your life experience is even the rural experience that you talk about, that right. I think is reemerging in conversation a little bit, at least from what I see and, you know, in some of those conversations. But let me ask this question. It's kind of like, you know, the double parts of this where, you know, I got really excited about ed policy. I've always been a political junkie, and, you know, I was involved in Illinois politics and different things when I was a younger man. And, you know, just, I remember No Child Left Behind shot me on kind of a trajectory as a professional teacher. But then when I was a union, I was actually a union leader for the AFT when I was in the public school district. And then, you know, it just kind of got me moving in a direction that asked, you know, began to allow me to ask a lot of questions about policy and why we do the things we do and what we do, that led me on a different trajectory. But I look over the last, you know, really, you know, 15 to 20 years, and you see the proliferation of options and opportunities for families and students, and even for schools to become, and I really like the idea of schools becoming more distinctive to meet the needs of their community and meet the needs of those students, whether it be Memphis, Tennessee, or where I was, you know, Chicago, Boston, or now California. But where are you seeing, like, you know, as you look at this, where are you seeing the states? You mentioned Florida. I know there's a lot going on in Wisconsin and Indiana and Arizona and these other places. Like, where are you seeing from a policy level or just even from opportunity level, really good things happening, you know, over the last number of years?
Right. Yeah, I think Florida really is the marquee example right now, to where I think the statistic is that if you go from pre-K to 12, upwards of 47% of kids are not going to their zoned district school. I mean, that's an incredible statistic, right? I mean, you can only, whereas I think the public notion, the broader public opinion notion would be that, oh, you know, 95% of kids go to a public school, right? No, the national statistic is actually only 82% go to a district school, and then the rest are going to charter schools, private schools, homeschooling, you name it. And I think Florida is leading the way in terms of that statistic. And we often point to the Miami-Dade School District, which is, I believe, is the fourth largest in the country. And 70% of kids do not go to their zoned district school. And that's incredible. And if you were to completely buy into the rhetoric of our opponents who say that, oh, if choice comes in here, it's going to crater the public school system. I mean, my goodness, Miami would just be, you know, a nuclear winter for 10,000 years because 70% of kids are not going to their district zone school. But guess what? I mean, their public schools have been rapidly improving over the past 10 years because families are empowered to choose the best school for their son or daughter. You know, my kids' education and where they should go to school might be completely different from your own, Eric, right? Even if they are of similar demographics or abilities and talents, I think there's just this notion out there that, well, if we put them all into this cookie cutter system, that's going to make everyone, you know, come out the other end of the factory assembly line much better. But I think Florida is proving that that's not the case. When you put choice on the table, and especially giving choices and options to lower income families like Florida's doing, you get miraculous results, because there's been, I think, over the past 20 or 30 years in the educational choice movement, to where those who are trying to expand charter schools and scholarship programs, whether they're vouchers or tax credit scholarships, and our organization's certainly been at the forefront of this for 20 or 30 years, you know, the focus has been on lower income families, because they're the ones that are ultimately hurt and falling behind within this current system. Because if you're, you know, wealthy, or you have the ability to either pay tuition at a private school or move your school district, and statistics show upwards of, I believe, 30% of families actually move to a different school district once their kids become of schooling age. You know, you start to go through that, and well, who are the ones that get the raw deal? And it's the ones who can't necessarily afford to move, and ultimately the kids are punished by that, right? That, you know, just by the genetic lottery, they fell into a family who just didn't have the means to get them into a different option. And I think that's where rightly so many of these states have said, look, let's expand these options for kids in dire situations, whether it's lower income children assigned to schools that have been chronically underperforming, special needs students, you know, military students who are, you know, moving all the time. You know, let's give them options first, and let's make sure that they get the ability to access a great education. And you brought up Arizona, Florida. If you look at states like that who have been rapidly expanding options for these populations, you're seeing, you know, double digit rises in terms of the test scores, whether it's the NAEP, you know, the National Assessment for Educational Progress, or any other sort of nationally normed reference test that's out there. You're seeing that these lower income children, and in Florida, the great example is this pocket of lower income kids, are performing better than the national average across all incomes in terms of their academics. So we brought the bottom up, and now too, I think there might be a push towards, in some states, really expanding options for kids who are high achievers in a lot of ways, who maybe in, you brought up No Child Left Behind. I think what about the notion of no kid held back in some sense, right? And I think what we did in Wisconsin a couple of years ago, or that we introduced, it didn't ultimately make it through the legislative process, but we introduced a gifted and talented scholarship program. So public sector, you know, public charter, private school teachers can nominate a kid to say, this student is gifted and talented in whatever subject. So art, math, reading, you name it. And then that kid would get like $1,000 education savings account that they get to put towards their education. I think you're going to see more of that in the future, to where once we can start really getting some of these kids that have been chronically behind, once we start getting that fixed, I think there might be a focus too on potentially giving high achievers more options too. But frankly, we still have our work cut out for us on getting that lower quartile of kids who are really far behind. And I mean, we're talking statistics like Baltimore, Philadelphia, Detroit, where kids are two or three or four grade levels behind where they should be. 90% of Black boys in Baltimore can't read at their grade level. I mean, this is a crisis, and we have a lot of work to do to try and fix many of these things. So that's some of my broad thoughts. Arizona, Florida, Indiana, Georgia, a number of these states that are really keeping their eye on the ball of lifting all boats and giving all kids educational opportunities, they're doing better. And those kids are doing better. And my goodness, you got to, in some sense, thank your lucky stars that if you were a lower income kid in any one of those states, you know, in the past 5 or 6 years, far different reality for you than maybe 20 or 30 years ago.
Well, and then you even look at like the report that was released about the Providence school districts in Providence, Rhode Island, and what a incredible, I mean, I guess, you know, disaster you would use for that of what's happening there and what's happening for students and the lack of opportunities. And I'm interested because, you know, we talk at the state level and a lot of this is really, you know, I remember in the early days, especially with places like DC and New York City and even Boston, and then Chicago picked up on it, LA, and then other cities where these mayors really picked up on, you know, greater options, greater accessibility, greater flexibility, even within their the public districts where they're creating magnet schools, pilot schools, you know, partner schools and doing all kinds of cool things. But we've kind of seen, you know, a reversal of that in a lot of these cities. And I know that, you know, you travel a lot and see a lot of these places in these cities. Like, so we're seeing the good things at a state level, but some of the reversal or some of the pulling back of a lot of the good work that has been done. Like, why is that? I mean, it's hard and I understand why it's happening, but maybe what's happening, why, but then what are the things that you're seeing are happening and like, what are the adjustments? Cause it's a little, I mean, frustrating for me to see the growth and then all of a sudden you see the pulling back.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that's a broader philosophical point, but based upon what I've read and what I've studied about the ebbs and flows of the movement over the past 20 or 30 years, I think in a lot of ways, you know, there's a member of our team who is on the ground and literally chief of staff to Governor Tommy Thompson when we passed the first voucher program in Milwaukee. And they talked about how they did any number of other dramatic reforms in other sectors, you know, not just education. And many of those other reforms took off and, you know, went to 40 different states almost within 5 years. And yet the school choice element didn't necessarily spread that quickly. I mean, maybe a dozen or so states, I forget the exact numbers, you know, had private school options. You know, charter schools moved at a little bit of a faster clip, but even still, you would think that some of these would expand much more rapidly, but that just goes to, I think, the institutional inertia or lack thereof from the education establishment to where, nope, it's all about keeping their grip on the current system, and that's how things work. And I laugh because I remember I had a college professor that talked in one class with us about, you know, let's say you had a blank canvas and you were going to design an education system for the United States of America. It would look nothing like the current system right now. I mean, what kind of Frankenstein's monster is this thing? And when you go back through, again, the history of, you know, how convoluted things were and how much of this system arose out of whether it's, you know, anti-Catholic bigotry or any number of factors that really diluted and polluted our system of education, we get to the point where we are now. But then as you look at, you know, the progress that has happened, it's been good, but in some ways, maybe like, well, the rise of charters over the late 90s and early 2000s, it was still such a small thing that it seemed great. And there maybe were only a handful of examples of issues that it gets glowing press coverage. But now when it starts to rise the level of, oh, 5 or 6% of the population of students are utilizing charter schools, you know, the unions and whomever else are opposing these options because they don't control those options and therefore they're not getting money into their campaign war chest to fight against these options, they start to see, uh-oh, we need to really stop this dead in their tracks. And so hence they start the disinformation campaign. And that yields to even what we saw last week here in September, to where there was this new group that came out called Public Funds, Public Schools. And there were a smattering of press reports about this new entity that was created to fight back against the privatization of our school system that's crippling our public education system. And again, you know, like handful of kids that are actually, in comparison to the 60 million schooling age population kids that are actually utilizing a public school choice or a private school choice option across the country. And you look at, and there was an expose that just came out this week on the group, and like you look at the financials and how the, you know, New Jersey teachers unions, the New York teachers unions, and the two national teachers unions essentially are funding 90% of this group. So it's not some new campaign or some new group. It's just a whole new thing. And it's just the same soup in a different bowl, as I think I commented to a few different friends with a little more colorful language. But you have this resistance from the education establishment that's doing everything it can to stop these options. And to put that in perspective, I mean, very often when we are engaged in a state, there may be times where those groups are spending 5 to 10 times as much as any of the coalition of education choice supporters are. So even while being outgunned, we've been pretty darn successful. And I think that goes to how this issue is on the right side of history. Parents deserve to have freedom when it comes to their child's education. It shouldn't simply just be this, well, we're going to create these arbitrary red lines around wherever you live, and tough luck. If you don't like it, you can pay to move. And then kids are treated essentially as just economic units, right? They're not being treated as kids with potential hopes and dreams and the ability to do well. And I think underpinning a lot of the opposition that still is there, even just to this notion of freedom and providing access and opportunity. And we hear this, I remember in Tennessee was when I first got my brush of this, where the head of the largest teachers union down there did a PBS interview, and he just flat out said that some parents are just too stupid to figure out what to do with their kids. And it was a very eye-opening experience for me, because yeah, they believe that some kids just cannot learn, and therefore we don't want to give them options because, oh, that would just be dangerous and they can't choose it. But they speak at the other side of their mouth saying, you know, we don't want to give, you know, parents options because they're too stupid. And then they'll also say, well, only the best kids are going to leave and take these choice options. And I'm like, well, which is it? Are the parents too stupid, or are the parents too smart? So it just goes to the sort of non sequitur nature of what we're fighting against, and how it really is just about power for these groups and nothing to do with actual educational outcomes or rational arguments.
So let me ask you a question about your work and what the AFC does and some of these. You talked about, you know, coalitions, and you talked about building, and some of it was just even, you know, this idea of educating parents. And I've seen some of the recent research on just communicating with parents. And I know the friends that I have that will listen to this, and the people that listen to it are people who love education. Most are teachers, educators, school leaders who are just trying to do good work in their schools and good job. Like, how do people like that, you know, with the work that you're doing at a national level or state level or some of these big things, like, how do people like that or people like us enter into these conversations and are a benefit to not only educating their community, educating parents, but then also being part of the larger, you know, maybe solution to some of these options?
Yeah, when you think about, as you said, the educators or folks who might be in the administration of schools, and let's even particularly talk about the district schooling system. I did an interview on Fox and Friends a few weeks ago where I just brought up this notion of how much we're spending in our education system. It's upwards of $750 billion per year. And when you look at that and you look at some other governmental entities, it's like, wow, that's as much as we spend in our Defense Department. And yet I don't think the Defense Department would tolerate the outcomes that we're getting if you applied the same statistics to our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines. And you look at that $750 billion number and you divide that up amongst the population of schooling age students, that's approximately $12,000 to $13,000 per year. And if you're a teacher in your district school system, and you're looking around and doing the headcount of students, there might be $250,000 worth of funding attached to that student. You know your salary, we know the averages, and you're probably wondering, where is the rest of this money going? And when you look at the statistics, and, you know, of course, the government makes this very difficult to do at the state and local levels of how the funding is being allocated, you might find that only 30 or 40 cents out of every dollar we spend on education is actually making it to the teacher or to the classroom in some fashion. And there's this bloated administrative bureaucracy that is really holding things up. I mean, I love, you know about athletics much more than I do, probably. I loved my high school athletics and everything, but you know, does a public school district really need, you know, three or four different assistant athletic directors and all these different things? Is that a really necessary expense? And maybe it is in some schools where kids are already doing well on other factors and they can justify it. But when you look across these districts and these schooling systems where, as we brought up earlier, I mean, upwards of 90% of kids might not be reading at their grade level in fourth grade, and it usually drops off after that into eighth grade and 12th grade. I mean, you're just assigning kids to a life of poverty potentially. And, you know, fundamental critical changes have to happen and reforms have to happen. And as I look throughout, you know, because we see at the national level all this work that we're doing to not only just talk about this issue in terms of advocacy of saying, look, that we deserve to have education freedom. We did this great video on the anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, where we're talking about how far have we come since 1963 when the March on Washington happened, right? I mean, what has happened? How many, young boys have been buried by their mothers? How many kids have had to go through that pipeline from school to prison? And what have we done to actually fix it? And frankly, I think the question is quite obvious. It's not enough. And that's why we're involved in anywhere between 12 to 18 states in a given year at doing advocacy work, you know, letting parents know what options exist in some states, saying, hey, this scholarship program exists. Here's how you can apply for it. Here's how you can get that tax credit scholarship. We're also doing policy changes. So we're working in the legislatures to craft high quality legislation that gives parents access to great schools. And then, as I brought up in the beginning, we get involved in elections because we believe, I mean, these changes have to happen at the state level, fighting district by district, school by school board by school board is just inefficient and can, you know, get untangled 2 years later when the groups that I said spend 10 times more than we do just can come in and already own the school systems as it is. So we're getting involved in elections. We're passing great laws. We're doing advocacy and letting parents know what options are available to them. And that's what makes us unique in the reform space. We're really the only group that does all three legs of those stool.
So, Tommy, I really appreciate your time. I mean, this is exciting. And maybe, you know, when we get closer to the 2020 election, have an opportunity to talk about like what you're seeing and, you know, because it, I mean, coming up, it's coming fast and it's a year away and it seems like, you know, it's already on top of us. And one of the biggest parts of, you know, the conversation has been, you know, education. And so it'll be really interesting to watch how this unfolds, but I really appreciate your time and I'm thankful for your energies and excited to see you on TV more as well as the work that you're doing. So thank you very much.
I frankly hope that you don't see me as much on TV as you might the kids who've actually benefited from educational options. One of the major programs that my team and I work day and night on is called Our Voices for Choice. You can go to that at voicesforchoice.net. We're trying to highlight the stories of these kids who have been impacted by having these educational policies in place in their states. And I mean, we have more than 130 on the website now. We're probably going to have 200 by the end of this month. You read through these stories and you can't help but get emotional because you know from the starting point of that story in that kid's life, it's usually pretty grim. It's usually pretty terrible. And then, boom, they get that better education. They talk about how they're actually excited to go to school. They actually love it. They're feeling safe. Any number of factors that play into this. And their lives are just, the whole trajectory is completely changed. So we're trying to elevate those voices into the media and into this conversation because, as we were just talking about a bit ago, you know, why maybe has there been some slowed progress? You know, I think part of that is we're speaking in the language of the think tanks, which is all well and good and is necessary. But at the same time, you elevate the voice of a kid who came from a impoverished background who can speak eloquently about, here's what happened in my life and why are you sitting up there wanting to deny me this option? You know, why should I have to sacrifice myself at the altar of the, you know, quote unquote public good? Getting back to that notion of where, you know, some say, oh, only the smart parents will be able to figure out how to navigate the choice system, you know, and therefore we shouldn't do it. I mean, what kind of technocratic garbage are you peddling in your own mind to say, well, look, we shouldn't, you know, fight for emancipation because it might not work out for some kids? I mean, it's just, to me, it's just fundamentally and morally unjust. And when we're elevating those kids' stories, they're a much better spokesperson on the issue than I am. I hope they all replace me in my job one day because they're just phenomenal. And we're training up these kids to be the next generation of advocates. So that Voices for Choice program, we're gathering, collecting, and then telling these stories in a compelling way. And then also we're training a few of them each year as part of our Future Leaders Fellowship, we call it, to be, you know, placed into education reform organizations because they want to get involved in this work. And it's the first time this has ever been done in the movement. So I think it's going to be an exciting few years ahead.
That's really cool. I'll tell you what, I've watched a lot of those videos and I, you know, and you mentioned the Martin Luther, you know, King, the I Have a Dream speech and the work that you put together to kind of share about that and share that student's story and that person's story. And it's amazing. And I'll tell you what, I'd love to talk to them. If you ever give me the opportunity to connect with them, love to talk to them, ask them about their story and even share a little bit more about just even, you know, the nitty gritty of what they've learned in the process too.
Sure. No, they, a few of them sit about 10 feet away from me. So we'll get them on next time.
Nice. Thanks, Tommy.
All right, Eric, have a great day. Thanks for having
me. You too.